few drivers have shaken up Formula One in quite the same way as Max Verstappen, already the youngest competitor in F1 history, having made his debut in 2015, aged just 17. His debut race for Red Bull in 2016 saw him winning the Spanish Grand Prix, the youngest driver ever to win a Grand Prix. James Gray, motorsport journalist and sporting journalist, has written the definitive new book on the super Dutch talent, Max Verstappen. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, James Gray. James, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Live from London.
Live from London, that's what we'd like to hear. Safe to say, this season, you know, he seems to be fulfilling his talent. Give us a little bit of background about, you know, where Verstappen comes from and a little bit about his father, Jos the Boss.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I say right at the beginning of the book that Max was kind of destined to be a racing driver, and I don't think it's ever been more true of anyone, really, because, you know, he was born between Grand Prix. Jos was racing in F1 at the time, and he came from the Nürburgring to see his new son and then flew off to Japan for the Japanese Grand Prix a couple of weeks later. His whole family basically run on diesel. You know, even his mother was an elite-level karter. Her father used to put on races, her brother races. Jos's father ran a karting team. Everything about the Verstappen family was about racing driving. So inevitably, you know, Max grew up on four wheels rather than two legs, really. And I think even, you know, Jos says that he saw him on a little sort of push bike, you know, those bikes without pedals. And even then, he could see that at the age of two or something, Max was riding the bumps and had really good balance. So he kind of knew from the beginning that this guy was going to be a racing driver. He always claims that he didn't push Max into it, and that if he wanted to stop at any point, he could have done. But I don't really know how true that is, to be honest, because Jos had a stop-start and kind of stunted F1 career. And I think he has always tried to kind of relive those mistakes, or not relive those mistakes, I should say, through his son.
Yeah, I mean, Jos, obviously, he had a time at Benetton, but he also raced for, was it with Minardi, and also, I think it was, yeah, was it
Arrows as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And he very nearly became a big part of the Honda F1 project when that was supposed to be coming back, but actually one of his good friends, the team boss, Pete Postlethwaite, tragically died during testing, and the project kind of collapsed. But yeah, I mean, for people who don't remember or maybe weren't around, Jos was... he was this big talent coming out of karting in the early 90s, and he turned up in Portugal and did a test drive, and, you know, he outdrove Derek Warwick, who some people will remember, the British driver, and he did times that were quicker than Derek had done in the race weekend, and he wasn't even driving F1 at the time. And all of a sudden, the phone starts ringing off the hook, and there's offers from everyone pretty much on the grid saying, we want you to come and drive for us. And as you mentioned, he went to Benetton, and it was probably too much too young.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be a test driver. JJ Lito got injured and fractured his neck in testing. And all of a sudden, Jos was thrust into, you know, these massive cars. And I think maybe what's different, and what people who aren't necessarily in tune with F1 won't understand, is that the modern F1 car is relatively easy to drive. I'm going to say that with a pinch of salt. I say relatively.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Whereas, you know, in the early 90s, these things are absolute beasts. They've got too much power, not enough downforce, so they're almost impossible to control. And just jumping into them as a young man, I think, was really hard for him. And, you know, he developed this unfortunate reputation. They used to call him Jos for crashing, because he just so often ended up in the gravel or in the wall. And he flitted from team to team. He was Michael Schumacher's teammate. And, you know, Max grew up quite good friends with Michael until obviously his tragic accident. So, you know, it gave Max a brilliant grounding in F1. But I think Jos, even now, and I don't think he would admit it now, but I think he always regrets not having done certain things in his career. But he's lucky because he now has his son. I think, you know, he takes great pleasure from the fact that Max is successful.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, though, the whole thing of Formula One is littered by guys who were really good but just didn't get the breaks. You know, Alan McNish, you know, Ralph Furman. Loads of good drivers who have gone on to do stellar things in other categories, but the die didn't really fall for them.
Yeah, it's kind of a unique sport in that sense that you very much don't necessarily get what you deserve, and you need to be so much more than just a racing driver. Jos was not someone who played politics very well. You know, he's a fiery character. He's been in trouble with the police a couple of times because he's got a lot of blood in him, as they say about horses. And, you know, that's something you have to do in F1. You have to be marketable and you have to be interesting. And it's why someone like Lewis Hamilton is so successful, is partly because he's a great racing driver, but also because he's very politically clever. He knows how to strike a marketing deal. He knows what's successful and what's not. And he knows where to go and when. I always talk about when he went to Mercedes from McLaren. Mercedes were not a quick team. In his first year there, they were the third, maybe the fourth fastest team on the grid. But he went into meetings with Niki Lauda and Toto Wolff, and he said, I think you've got something here, and I think you're going to spend the right money in the right way. And of course, he was right. And Jos never managed to do that, you know, sticking and twisting when he should have been sticking. And I think that's such a skill in F1, not just maneuvering your way through cars on the grid, but maneuvering your way around the grid as the years go by.
Yeah, and Lewis also had the good fortune to be sort of mentored by Niki Lauda, who was instrumental, wasn't he, on getting that Mercedes deal. And, you know, if you need a mentor, which perhaps Jos didn't have, then he had, you know, he had Niki, Lewis had Niki. And if you want good financial advice and politics, Niki was a master statesman.
Exactly. It's funny, really, because Jos's mentor was a guy called Hoob Ruthengatter, who raced a little bit in the 80s and 70s, and he was known as the Rat, because if your contract was looking like it might expire, Hoob would turn up at the door of your race director and say, I might be a bit cheaper for the last couple of races. So he ended up all over the place, and I suspect that may have had some contribution to Jos's downfall in some ways, that he had a wheeler dealer might be a bit harsh, but I think most people who know Hoob would agree with that.
I mean, just because you are the son of a racing driver, though, doesn't exactly mean you're going to be quick. Okay, you know, we've had Damon Hill, we've had, you know, Jacques Villeneuve, but we've, for every one of that, we've had a Piquet Jr. You know, we've had the Brabham brothers, great drivers, but, you know, they couldn't cut it in F1.
Yeah, absolutely. It goes so many different ways. I mean, I wrote, you know, best part of a chapter just about all these different father-son relationships. The Damon Hill one is very interesting because he didn't really have any interest in racing until his father died in that plane crash. And then he kind of felt an obligation to go out and pick up his father's legacy. There's partly a financial pressure there as well, because they sadly lost a hell of a lot of money when Greg died. But it's very interesting the way it affects different people. And Damon, he wasn't that quick for a long time. He preferred bikes, really. And then eventually, you know, he got that place and got into the right car at the right time. And I think the thing is, when no matter whether you're good or bad, the one thing you're always fighting against, if your father or mother, I suppose, was a racing driver, is that people think you're there because of your name. And it can be incredibly unfair. And, you know, Nelson Piquet Jr. talks about it a fair bit, that it was very hard having that name on the F1 grid. And yeah, he probably wasn't as good as the opportunities he had. And Max, I think, is maybe a little bit lucky that he so quickly outshone his father. You know, within the space of 18 months, he had achieved more than Jos achieved in his entire 9-year F1 career. And I think had that not happened, you definitely might have started to see question marks over, oh, this Max Verstappen guy, he's very young, and he's also just the son of an F1 driver. Why is he really there? You know, the Fittipaldis have it the same way. So, yeah, you're right. They're not always quick, but it certainly helps having someone who knows their way around the business.
I mean, talking about, you know, achieving more in your, whatever, 18 months. I mean, in 18 months, he achieved more than the entire Dutch racing fraternity had done, and that includes drivers like, you know, Jan Lammers, you know, Hiels van Leppen. Nobody had won a Grand Prix from Holland until he came along.
No, it's kind of fascinating that he has this absolutely cult following in the Netherlands, given their, as you say, almost complete lack of motor racing pedigree. You know, Zandvoort, the track where we're finally going to go back to in September,
for
the Dutch Grand Prix, it's a very exciting track, but it was an absolute death trap for a long time. And it was also not a very financially viable track. You know, Bernie Eccleston pretty much went on Dutch TV the weekend of the last Dutch race and said, we're not coming back, it's a waste of time, we don't make any money, in a way that only Bernie really can. And so it's bizarre that Max now packs out stadiums. He pretty much saved the Belgian and Austrian Grand Prix exclusively by the fact that tens of thousands of Dutch people were willing to drive hundreds or even close to thousands of miles to go and pay buy tickets and camp out and watch him race. So I've kind of tried to get to the bottom of it. And truth be told, I don't know if I have an answer for that, why the Dutch are so mad about it. I think they just love sport. You know, whatever sport they're good at, whether it be the football team or obviously the very good hockey side or whatever it is, they do seem to get really right behind. And I think Max's talent, his personality, you know, he's quite fiery, he's quite down to earth. I think that goes down well in the Netherlands. I think that all kind of contributed to this extreme fandom, which you now see in the Netherlands.
I mean, we'll come on to Zandvoort in a bit because it's going to be an occasion. You know, I'm really looking forward to that Grand Prix for several reasons. Where were the first signs then that Max was quick? You know, did he go through the usual way of you know, karting at basically 4 years old and work his way up through the formula? Because it seems to be, he came out of, not out of nowhere, but again, it, you know, racing, becoming the youngest racing driver, you know, ahead of, obviously I'm in Spain, so Alonso's a big thing, and there was Mike Thackwell before then. So he, you know, he entered the sport at an incredibly young age.
Yeah, well, it's the very earliest kind of racing memory that anyone has of Max is when he was 3 years old. He'd been promised that he could have a go-kart when he was four, but Jos wanted to buy it for him and be there when he went out in it for the first time. And he was at a racetrack in Belgium where he grew up, and he was with his mum. Jos was away racing, and he saw one of his mates, one of the Peps boys, who he would go on to kart with much later on, out racing. And he said, well, he's younger than me, and he's in a go-kart. That's not fair. And so he cried and cried and, you know, pulled on his mum's hand. And she rang Jos and said, look, I think we're going to have to get him a go-kart because he's just not going to say no. So he was, I think he just turned four when Jos finally got him in a go-kart, stuck him out in one session in this tiny little go-kart. And immediately Max outgrew it, not in terms of physicality, but he drove it to its limit within two or three laps. So Jos took it back and it now hangs on the wall of their museum. And he bought them the bigger one because he realized already that there wasn't enough power in this tiny engine to get Max going quickly. So I think that's the real, you know, pretty much the first second he stepped into a go-kart, they knew he was going to be pretty quick. And then, you know, you're not allowed to race competitively until you're 8 years old, but they did pretty much as soon as he was allowed to. They went up to a race in Northern Holland, a pretty destitute racetrack, to be honest. I've cycled around that area of the world quite a lot, and it's quite flat, obviously, famously, and quite windy. And they've driven a decent distance. And there's a great picture of Jos just hanging on the chain link fence, you know, almost scraping his nose through it as Max takes off in his first race. And of course he won it because he won 55 of his first 59 competitive go-kart races. So there really wasn't a point at which he wasn't quick in go-karts. And you know, once they put him in single-seaters, it was like a duck to water.
So what was his progression through the single-seaters? Because, I mean, obviously, was it Formula Renault first and then doing F3?
I mean, there basically wasn't a progression, quite frankly. You know, he was well-known, even in karting. A lot of people knew who he was, partly because of the Jos connection. And Jos, for the record, is a brilliant go-kart driver and is still very highly respected in the go-karting world in Northern Europe. Especially in what they call the Benelux region, you know, Luxembourg, Belgium, and the Netherlands. And so his reputation was growing, and he secured a test, funnily enough, of all places in South Wales, just outside Llanelli. There's an airbase, an old airbase that gets used for testing. And he was given a go in a former Renault car. And there's a great moment. One of Jos's old friends, who's a photographer, recalls it. When they were just sitting in the hotel at, you know, 1 a.m. the night before, Max is long in bed, and they get this sense that they're going to remember this moment, and that it was a real kind of watershed moment for his career. And they say, well, we'll just see what it's like tomorrow. And they wake up and it's South Wales and it's August. So, of course, it's hammering down with rain. And they go, well, this could be quite tricky. And Max goes out and starts putting up times that would have matched guys at the same level in the dry. And the engineers just can't believe it. The engineers just have no idea how a kid, you know, at the age of whatever he was, 13, 14, was able to put up these times, despite the fact that he basically had no experience in a car with a proper engine in it. okay, he'd driven, you know, shifting carts, as they're called, carts with gearboxes, but he really didn't, he shouldn't have known what he was doing. And yet he's out there, just outperforming everyone in a test. And he did a lot of testing over that year, you know, the last year of his karting career, and then got this drive with Van Amersfoort Racing. Kind of a, he had a lot of options in what's called, what used to be called Formula 3 Europe, but it's essentially the sort of third tier of single-seater racing. And he had options in Formula Renault as well, which would have been a bit below that.
Yeah.
But yeah, he went for Formula 3, partly, I think, because it was a Dutch team. Jos knew them well. They spoke Dutch in the garage. And while Max's English is very good and was good at the time, obviously there's a comfort there of being able to work in Dutch. And Jos wanted to be a bit more restrained. And they weren't necessarily the quickest car on the grid. There were other offers out there, like Prema, who are strongly linked with Ferrari, and they usually have the quickest cars in those series. But I think there was a strong feeling from Jos that he wanted Max to be comfortable. You know, Max is quite an emotional guy. He does wear his heart on his sleeve, and I think can be affected by these kind of things. And so it was important for him to be comfortable. And yeah, he did one season with Van Amersfoort and just lit the world up. It's crazy. I can't think of anyone in F1 who's only done one season in single seats. It's almost completely unheard of.
And then, I mean, that leap from, for, you know, Formula 3 or whatever you want to call it into F1 is massive, because it doesn't matter how, you know, again, it doesn't matter how good you've been, you know, coming up through the feeder series. When you get to Formula 1, I mean, again, the road is littered with drivers like Zonta, who came up Formula, you know, 3000 championship back in the day. Loads, Zanardi, of course, who was, you know, brilliant in every Formula apart from F1. And they get to the pinnacle of the sport. And it all falls apart, and Max absolutely didn't, and at the youngest age.
Yeah, and what people probably don't realise is that almost every driver, barring a few who, you know, pay their way into the sport, almost every driver comes in as a champion or nearly a champion in these junior formulae. If you don't finish in the top three, you just don't get an F1 drive. So everyone had pretty much achieved what Max achieved. All right, not in the same space of time. So when he gets into an F1 car, and his first ever F1 drive was in Japan, you know, which I think was actually great because the drivers all love Suzuka. Jos had a strong link with Honda, obviously. And so there was a lot of kind of emotion there. And they had to change the rules. Well, they changed the rules after Max, but they also changed them before him, because he turned 17 the night before his first ever drive in an F1 car.
Right.
So they had to give him a super license, you know, which is basically like a driving license, but super. And they had to give him one before he was 17, which they'd never had to do before. And then they didn't really know what to do. You can't do it anymore. You have to be 18. They changed the rules. But yeah, he turned up, and I think what was really different is it's not just I've got to do well for my career and impress people here. You know, he was driving Jean-Éric Vergne's Red Bull Toro Rosso, as it was then. And if he crashed that, it wasn't just his career that was in trouble. Jean-Éric Vergne really needed a good race car that weekend, which he could have put in the wall, set them back days of work, you know, given them much less time, damaged the car, hundreds of thousands of pounds of damage, and all that pressure on a 17-year-old. And to be honest, there was one moment, and it's actually very funny. He was in Brazil, actually, a couple of weeks later in another test, where he just has a moment in the damp in Brazil, as almost everyone does, and he catches it. Which, for people who haven't driven a race car, it's very hard to describe how difficult this is to do. But everything is telling you to steer one way. And actually, in order to stop yourself hitting the wall, you have to let go of the brakes, steer into the skid and catch it.
Yeah.
And he does it. And the TV cameras cut to the pit wall, where they all react hands on heads when they think he's going to crash it into the wall. And then Jean-Éric Vergne just sort of purses his lips and goes, This kid can do something. And that kind of sums it up for me, is almost at no stage has there really been much doubt in Max's career. Maybe a little later, you know, when he always is a very aggressive driver, and some people don't like that, but certainly in the early years, people were impressed just with his sheer skill set.
And also, I mean, the amount of pressure, because he's come up through Red Bull, okay? And Red Bull, yeah. You know, through Toro Rosso and through Red Bull itself, have been, there is no room for error or romantic attachment or emotional attachment. Red Bull has got, you know, you think about Scott Speed, Daniel Kvyat, Alex Albion, you know, what's his, the New Zealand guy who was let go. I mean, they get let go of drivers.
Hardly, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. They let go of drivers, you know, without a second thought. They are ruthless in their pursuit of excellence.
Yeah, and this kind of stems from the guy who gave Max his first contract, Dr. Helmut Marko, who, you know, he's an Austrian former racing driver. He pretty much lost an eye in a crash, and that's why he quit. And right from, you know, the beginning, he's good friends with Dieter Mateschitz, who is the man behind Red Bull in Europe. And right from the mid-90s, he wanted to build this team, you know, carrying young drivers from junior series into F1. And he wanted that to be part of the brand. And that's why they're so ruthless, really, because it is a marketing tool. And that they're not there to poodle around in the midfield with old drivers and do nothing. They're there to make a splash and represent the brand. And Dr. Marko is brutal. I mean, he is absolutely brutal. You know, Daniel Kvyat, the Russian driver who's been dropped by Red Bull a number of times, tells a good story about testing in the wet. And Marko rang him up at 6 a.m. of the day, the third day of the test, because he always rings people early in the morning. And he said, "So, you can't drive in the wet, yes?" And Daniel said, "Well, I'll try and get better." And he said, "We'll see." And then just hung up. And there was no, like, advice. It was a 30-second phone call for no apparent reason other than to make Daniel feel bad about himself. So, yeah, it is a brutal environment, but I think Max really responds well to that. You know, Jos has always been a hard taskmaster.
Yeah.
He doesn't really know about carrots. He really only knows about stick and bigger stick. So I think he responds pretty well to that, and he enjoys the challenge of, you know, Dr. Marko being this incredibly hard-to-please boss.
I mean, the victory in the Spanish Grand Prix was quite something, and all of Holland went wild. And if you get the chance to see, if you've ever seen the Dutch TV commentators, which I saw on YouTube, their reaction when he wins, I mean, it's a thing of beauty, isn't it? And it really is. But I mean, to keep a calm head, because once again, you know, F1 is littered with people who've been at the front and thrown it away, and people like Martin Brundle, who never won a Grand Prix, Bruno Giacomelli, never won a Grand Prix, you know, all these great drivers, Chris Amon, who were at the top of the game, but never got the break, and here he comes, you know, at this incredibly young age and wins the Spanish Grand Prix.
Yeah, exactly. It was, I don't think they could have dreamed it. I often, you know, I put the theory about, and I've done some digging on it, that they deliberately, because they moved Max up mid-season, they replaced him, you know, during the season, replaced Kvyat, in fact.
Yeah.
And I've often kind of thrown the theory around that they picked the Spanish Grand Prix as the day to do it, because they thought they had a chance of winning, and it would have been a perfect storm, if you like. But they really weren't supposed to win that race. There were a couple of mistakes elsewhere that kind of created an opportunity for them, but there was no inkling that they were going to win that race other than for what happened on the day and the opportunity that presented itself. And you're right, it would have been so easy for Max to just lose his cool and panic that all of a sudden he was going to win a Grand Prix race. But I think he'd shown, you know, he was already nearly 20 races into his career by now, more than 20, in fact, having had a year with Toro Rosso, the junior Red Bull team. And I think he'd already shown that he could be pretty cool. You know, Carlos Sainz Jr. was his teammate, another man with a famous racing name, of course. And there had been fiery moments, and Max had generally kept his temper, you know, in check, which, of course, was famously what his father was never able to do. And his mother, Sophie, she often says that the racing he got from Jos and his temper he got from me, from Sophie, because he's actually, for a racing driver, a pretty heartfelt guy. You know, he's got a little stepsister from Jos's third marriage, and he's now got a little nephew, Luca, as well. His sister's had a child. And I know I don't live with him. I'm not saying I sit with him at Christmas, but there's a lot of stuff on his Instagram, and he's very sweet, really. You know, for a boy of, well, he was born in 97, so he's only 24. And I think most 24-year-old, especially 24-year-old sportsmen, not that interested in kids, not that bothered by other people's kids especially. But he's very sweet, really, and he bought his stepsister this little Red Bull-branded sort of ride-on truck thing when she was born, and so got her name embroidered on the side of it, and you know, I think that actually makes him a much better racing driver. Yes, he has hot-headed moments, and you know, that he had a fight with Esteban Ocon in a garage, which is very unsavory. But I also think that that sensitivity and makes him a very affable guy in a team. And we talked earlier about how important it is to be able to win sponsors and things, and to be able to navigate your way through F1. A lot of that is politics. A lot of that is keeping your mechanics and your engineers on your team. And I think he's very good at that. And he's a good people person, which goes a long way.
I mean, we had the situation maybe 10 years ago where we were in danger of there being no passion, and the people are saying, oh, it's just the drivers are all mechanical, they're interchangeable. But you've got Josh, you've got Max, and also the driving style. He goes for it, you know, as does Lewis. You know, he doesn't sit there midfield and go, okay, fine. I mean, he really is a driver's driver.
Yeah, he absolutely is. And he's part of this new generation, really, of drivers who do go for it. I mean, it hasn't always paid off. There's a famous story in when he was still in karting, when they were down in Sarno, just outside Naples, and Max was dominating it. It was a year when he was really, really fast in a go-kart. And basically, go-karting weekends, to the uninitiated, sort of, there are a series of races, and your position in the next race depends on your position in the last one, and then the final is the final race. And during the final, Max had pretty much won every race. He started on the front. But the nature of the track is that there's quite a lot of slipstreaming on the main straight, and it can be easy to overtake. And Max gets overtaken in the first lap, and he's annoyed because he doesn't like getting overtaken. No one does. He's also 14, 15, and therefore, you know, a little bit impetuous. And so instead of waiting for the next lap when he could just slipstream exactly as the guy did to him and then try and get away, he goes for, and I've seen the footage, a pass which Ayrton Senna in God mode couldn't have made. But there's no gap there at all. It's just pure rage. And he tries to make the overtake. He spins out and he loses the race. And his dad doesn't talk to him for a week. In fact, they've got an 1,100-mile drive back. And Max, because of the way he is and because of his nature, he's trying to talk to his dad about it. And, you know, in conflict, I think there are two types of people. There's the people who clam up and say nothing, and the people who just want to fix it. Max is very much that second person. And Jos is just having none of it. He's like, just stop talking. I don't want to talk about it. You got it wrong. You messed up. Anyway, about 10 minutes later, they stop at a fuel station, and Jos says to Max, get out, and then drives off. And he leaves his 14-year-old son at a petrol station just outside Naples, which for anyone who's been to Naples is a pretty intimidating prospect.
Yeah, right.
The funny thing about that story is that it gets retold quite a lot and in quite different ways by different people. So Jos says that he drove away for 5 minutes and then turned around and came back and picked him up. Max says that his mum was driving 15 minutes behind and that actually Jos was long gone into the sunset and that he had to ring his mum and she had to scoop him up. Which I think says a lot. There's a lot of rewriting of history trying to be done there. And I think that more people seem to suggest that Sophie was the one who picked him up and eventually drove him home. But Jos certainly didn't talk to him for a week after that because he was so angry. And I think that really stuck with him. I think that really had an effect on Max, you know, just about that impetuousness that he had and about how much work goes in. Because that weekend, there'd been problems with the car. Jos had stayed up most of Friday night fixing the clutch, which had burnt out during practice. And that taught him a lot, I think, about, you know, what can go wrong on a race weekend and how much responsibility you as a driver have to not make those mistakes and to control your emotions during a race.
They always say as well that the person you have to beat is your teammate. And over the past couple of seasons, he's had some pretty decent teammates, including Daniel Ricciardo and Carlos Sainz Jr. And he's come out best of all of them, isn't he? So he really is, you know, he really does sort of, not in the way that perhaps Lewis did with Fernando Alonso, but he seems to be leading the team without perhaps just through sheer speed alone rather than sort of mind games.
Well, it helps that they've got on his side as well. Like Red Bull have pretty much, you know, they've decided which basket their eggs are going into and they've gone full on with Max. And so they even designed the car the way he wants them to. You know, Albon, who obviously sadly got dropped and isn't in F1 this year, he said how unstable the rear of the car is. And, you know, some drivers like it when you can throw the rear around a bit and you can turn in very hard. But a lot of drivers don't. Max does, and so Red Bull designed the car that reacts well to that. And as much as, yes, he's also outdriven his teammates, certainly early on in his career, I think he's also in a situation now where the car is built for him, and it doesn't really matter who the other person in the garage is, that they're just sort of there for window dressing and occasionally rear gunning. So I think it helps massively that the car is built almost specifically for him. It's not to say he's not quick, he is, but Red Bull have really doubled down on Max Verstappen. They believe he's going to be the next world champion, and they don't seem to be far off.
And talking of which, after the victory at Monaco this weekend, and last weekend, and some would say, okay, well, Charles Leclerc had a bit of misfortune because his car wasn't ready in time or couldn't start. I mean, for the first time, he's now leading a world championship. And some might say,
yeah, I'm not going to lie. In terms of good timing, the book coming out on Thursday and Max taking the lead in the World Championship on Sunday is pretty handy.
Exactly.
But yeah, I didn't think pre-season this was going to be an interesting year of F1 at all. I thought Mercedes would walk it and that Hamilton would be world champion again, and that would be fine. But you know, regulation change coming in 2022 would be the interesting one. But he's really defied all expectations, and I think that's down to Red Bull and Honda. Really, They've worked incredibly hard to peg back Mercedes. They've got some good rulings from the FIA. It always helps when the referee's on your side, it would appear. And yeah, they're right up there. I don't see why it's not going to go down to the last race of the season. And I think that would be spectacular for anyone involved in sport.
And talking of spectacular, we have to look forward to what I'm going to call Verstappen stock, otherwise known as the Dutch Grand Prix, coming back to Zandvoort. Now, this is a circuit, like you said, it's got a checkered history. There have been some terrible crashes there, but it's also had a great history for British drivers and for the British fans. And they've come across, you think of James Hunt's win in 1975 for Hesketh, over there. It's a great, it's an atmospheric circuit. It's one of the old names, and it's going to be absolutely, magnificent.
I mean, it's going to be entirely orange, the entire track. I mean, wouldn't be surprised if they paint the tarmac orange if they can get away with it. It's completely unique. I don't think there is another F1 track or racetrack in the world like it, because it's built on sand dunes, big sand dunes, and it banks around these corners. No sane person would build a racetrack on those sand dunes.
It's the Dutch.
It's something else. It was basically a mayor in the 1930s who thought it would be a great way to attract people to this seaside resort. And so he started building it, and then the Netherlands obviously got invaded by the Nazis. And he then convinced the Nazis to build it for him somehow. He said, it'll be a great place for you to parade your soldiers, in a victory parade when the war ends. And they went, oh, that's a good idea. Yes, we'll build this big, long thing. And in his head, he was just thinking, well, that's a great home straight for me.
Right.
And then he said, your soldiers need somewhere to exercise. Could we maybe build them the sort of bicycling track through the woods and through the dunes? And they said, that's a good idea. We'll do that as well. And that became the basis for the rest of the track. And then when the Nazis moved out in the 40s, he probably went, come on, lads, we'll just widen the road a bit and turn it into a racetrack. Which is just the most marvellous piece of ingenuity and kind of one of those weird stories that comes out of the war. But yeah, you're right. It's a spectacular racetrack. It's going to be absolutely full to the rafters, hopefully, everything being well.
Yeah.
And it could well be a chance for Max to win the most special race of his career. And he has won there before. He raced in the Marlborough Masters there during his F3 season, which is used to be a very famous race. And actually, Jos won it as well. And he absolutely dominated it. He won it by about 55 seconds or something. But there weren't many people there, and I think it was a pretty cold day in sort of April or May, as the North Sea coast can be at that time of year. So this will be a much more glamorous occasion, I hope.
And as you say, I mean, this is a Formula One star, but he's still in his early 20s. This, we could be seeing another decade of Verstappen dominating F1.
Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, he's only 24. He's in his eighth season in F1, which is obviously staggering. But he is only 24. He turns 25 in September. Kimi Raikkonen is still going. He's pushing 40. The Max could have 15 years in this sport. And Red Bull are not going nowhere. They've had huge success. in Formula One. They're so committed to getting back to the top of the table, as we've seen. This could be a real legacy. I think he could be the greatest driver of all time, and I'm not just saying that because I've written a book about him.
The book is called Max Verstappen, The Inside Track on Formula One Star. It's out on Icon Books. It's just published on Icon Books. It's by James Gray. James, if people want to find you or find out more about the book, is there social media? Where can they get hold of you?
Yeah, if you can find me on Twitter, the best place for it, James Gray Sport. But if you just Google Max Verstappen book, you will see the bright orange cover, and you can find that pretty much anywhere you buy books.
It's very bright indeed. Just a quick one: Are you gonna make your way over then to Verstappen stock? Do you think?
Well, all being well and travel being allowed, yes, I hope so. It's a cracking part of the world. It's not far from Amsterdam Zandvoort either. So, yes, I might make a week of it. I hear there's a few sites in Amsterdam.
Indeed. Let's move swiftly on. The book is called Max Verstappen, The Inside Track on a Formula One Star. It's by James Gray. James, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you very much.